Welcome to the Open Hearted Podcast. Hello and welcome to the Open Hearted Podcast. I'm your host, Will Wheeler, joined with my main man, Photon John. What's going on, brother?
Hey, man. Just kicking along. You know, that music now kind of puts me in a happy place.
Puts you in a happy place. That's what it's all about, mate. That's what it's all about, being in a happy place, right? Hey, you know, while I remember, happy 1 year anniversary with the podcast.
Yeah, we have forgotten to speak about that. A year.
Yeah, so everyone who's listening, last episode was actually the year that it'd been a year. And I think just with everything going down, what happened last podcast, we completely forgot about it. So congratulations, my man. You're doing a great job.
You too, my friend. You too.
You know, so awesome times. But I tell you what, we should get stuck into this. We've got a really awesome guest coming on the show today. I might call her up, Shay Whissell, all the way from Melbourne. Shay, what's going on?
Hello, congratulations on your 1 year celebration.
Yeah, it's We got you there. Thank you so much. Time flies when you're having fun, maybe, but it's actually been really cool to see it start, it grow, and slowly see a few listeners come on. But I tell you what, Shay, as much as I'm excited to talk about that, I'm more excited to really be talking about dyslexia in the workplace, and who better to have come on than yourself?
Oh, thank you. It's exciting to be here to talk about our favorite topic.
Yeah, totally. And you know, I think the thing is, especially with dyslexia in the workplace, is that, you know, we know the numbers. Dyslexia is like the highest in like the neurodiversity umbrella there. And yet there's really little information, or it's very rarely spoken about within corporate, schools, stuff like that. So, you know, it'd be really cool to, you know, talk a little bit about that type of stuff, the work you're doing, you know, with your charity and your organization, Rethink Dyslexia, and really just, you know, get stuck into this. But before we do go into it, I might just do a quick shout out for anyone listening. Now, if you're listening, please subscribe, like, and follow to all of our social media platforms. We're now available on TikTok, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, Twitch, YouTube, LinkedIn, and please go to our website, theopenheartedsociety.com, and please subscribe and check out all of our blogs and other past episodes. Photon John, you ready to rock and roll, my man?
I am ready, my man.
Nice. So before anything, Shay, you know, I think our listeners really want to hear, you know, everything about you, you know, so tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, apart from feeling crooked, I know you keep saying I'm not, so sorry if I keep moving my head in odd ways.
It's all good. Don't bring attention to it.
It's my crooked dyslexic brain. Well, I think, gosh, Will, we've known each other for a number of years now, haven't we?
Time flies when you're having fun, right?
Yeah.
That's what you want to call it.
Well, I think it's been a mix of fun and a mix of not so much fun. But, yes, it's fun being here today, so thank you. Well, my journey started at 27 when I was first diagnosed with dyslexia. Well, that's when I say I first became dyslexic, but I was really born this way. So it's but it first came to light when I was 27, even though I'd been through my secondary school and undergraduate degree and had struggled but never really understood what was wrong as such with me or why I couldn't do things like everyone else. And so one night I was having a tutor over and she was helping me with my writing and I was really frustrated and tears were in my eyes because I didn't understand why I couldn't write this sentence for uni, and that's when she said to me, I think you might be dyslexic. And I, even as a speech pathologist, I didn't understand what that meant. And so at uni, I was lucky enough to get diagnosed there. I had to pay, I think it was $600 at the time. And I was diagnosed with dyslexia and dysgraphia, so two types of learning disabilities or neurodivergences, whatever term people like to use. And after that, I had a significant and hopefully one and only mental health breakdown, where I was where I had attempted suicide a couple of times and was in and out of hospital for a couple of years, really. And it was really my mum, who's no longer with us, that and my family that really helped me get through that time. And following that, every time I went into work and I disclosed in a new role that I had dyslexia, no one knew what that meant. And I was always faced with a lot of barriers because of my writing and bullying and discrimination and questioning around why I couldn't do things like other people, accused of cheating in some of my jobs. I wasn't paid the salary offered in one job because I said I needed some support. So a variety of issues that were happening to me, and I lost my job in the first 6 months and I'd moved up to Mildura, and because of my dyslexia, they terminated me, but and they could because I was in that six-month probationary period. And I actually went to the CEO and said, this can't happen. I have this disability or difficulty and I've moved my whole life up here. And so they put me into a different role. But after that, I rang my mum and said, I can't do this anymore. I can't keep being treated like this. And so I first set up the foundation, which was through podcasts, and they went live in 2016, I think, and we've got 57 episodes out now.
Can I ask what the yeah. name of your podcast is, just so our yes. listeners can hear or go and listen to it maybe?
Yeah, sure. It's Dear Dyslexic. Which is also the name of our charity, and it's listened to globally. And that's really how we started the charity, was setting up the podcast, and we became a national charity. And then last year we diversified and we started Rethink Dyslexia, which really focuses on the workplace and adult support based on my research I've done with La Trobe. This week's been a huge week. I just submitted my thesis. So hopefully in the next 6 months I'll become a doctor.
Congratulations. Thank you. Now, how do you feel?
I feel a bit deflated. I need to go and buy myself another bottle of champagne and a bunch of flowers, I think.
But what a great, you know, experience. Oh, well, you know, how was the experience actually? Like, did you find that now that you've been doing a lot of work in this area, that it did make the experience a little bit better because you had a bit better of an understanding than, say, when you first went to university?
Yeah, I mean, now because I've done all my study actually through La Trobe, so being a student with them for, 20 years probably, it was one of the hardest things for me because my writing is significantly impaired. My reading is slow. But it's how I articulate myself on paper. And so my mum always edited my work for me, and then my auntie. But at a PhD level, you really need external editing support. And so that was really hard for me to get, and it took quite a while. And my supervisors really supported me and being able to access that support. But you can get it, and it is out there. But sometimes, you know, it's quite exhausting. We have to self-advocate so much, whether it's in the workplace or whether it's when we're trying to study or in other things that we're doing in life.
And Kev.
Can I just say it's highly impressive how much study you got through prior to diagnosis, considering face. That blew me away.
You know, like, and like, is this a common thing? Like, you know, we often see with especially females that they fly under the radar a lot of the time. Like, I know for me at school, I was very, you know, you could tell very well that I was struggling with something because I was loud. I was always getting in fights with a teacher, you know. And we're seeing that, you know, obviously with females that they can fly under the radar. I'm assuming that was the problem with yourself as well, Shay?
Yeah, I think, you know, I was a people pleaser from a very young age. And I think girls really do internalize, and then that can become a lot of depression and anxiety for us, where boys seem to externalize, where it's kind of like the behaviors you're talking about, mm-hmm. Will. And that's what happened for my brother. Like, he, you know, left by year nine because he was really, he couldn't cope in the school system, and he was diagnosed after me. So it is, and I think, you know, my mum helped me so much without realizing. And, you know, the when we talk about the neurodivergent population, a lot of times we hear masking and how good people with autism are at masking. And I think, you know, that's in the dyslexic, you know, in our group, we don't really talk about as masking, but we put in a number of coping strategies so people can't see. Mm. And so different language, but the same thing, you know, we're really good at hiding what we can't do, particularly in that kind of group environment. And I always talk about how I hung out with the smart kids. So I always made sure I sat next to someone who could help me spell the words or could help me with maths unintentionally. And then when I got into the workplace, I always found the people that could help me, like the admin person that was really good at writing, or, you know, the IT person that was going to be really kind and helpful in doing things for me and helping me in the workplace. So I always tended to find an ally or some allies to help me throughout uni as well. I found I don't think we're the smart group, we were probably the struggles at uni, but we all got together and we helped each other. So I was always really good at networking and building relationships with people so that I could leverage my strengths but also leverage other people's strengths to get by.
Yeah, cool. You know, that's been such an experience for you, and, you know, you're going on and doing some great things. So, you know, tell us a little bit about your work in the dyslexia field. And I think a big thing is I have, you know, a lot of people know I'm dyslexic as well. And to tell you the truth, since I've met you, I've actually been diagnosed as ADHD as well. So things have changed, you know. But, you know, I think when I think of, you know, especially dyslexia here in Australia, I always think of yourself, you know. I think of, you know, because I know a bit, but I just feel that you're more sort of the person, the go-to person in this field. So, you know, share with our listeners a little bit of the work you're doing in regards to dyslexia, because I think, you know, the hardest thing I sometimes find, and I'm not sure if you're the same, Shay, but especially with social media and a lot of influencers, we see them sharing a lot of information that can be quite helpful, but sometimes I just don't think that information is correct sometimes, you know, where I think with yourself, you are finding that evidence, you're doing a lot of research, all of that. So please share a lot of the stuff you're doing.
Well, I think part of it is my lived experience, and everyone's experience is different. You know, there are some similarities, you know, the mental health challenges, you know, my story is not unique. It's very common to end up with depression and anxiety, and we're 46% more likely to attempt suicide. So I think going through university really helped me to ground me in having some evidence about what was happening, because when I went to do my doctorate, I just thought I can't be the only one. And, you know, as a speech pathologist, I'd worked with a lot of young men and young boys in secondary school and in the prison system, and I thought, what happens to these young people? How do they get the support? Because I knew it was through my family that I got my support and that I could not just survive but really thrive in the end. And I think that was some of the driving factors for me doing my research, so we could get a better understanding of what was happening to adults with dyslexia, because there was nothing out there. There is, you know, a lot of international research, but not driven by dyslexics themselves. Some of it is, and there's some great international research done by dyslexics, but not a lot in the workspace. And I think, you know, we're 1 in 10 of the population. We're 50% of the neurodivergent population. My research shows that we work in every industry at every level, from on the ground staff through to CEOs, board directors. So we can't make an assumption that because someone's dyslexic, they haven't been able to put those strong strategies in place to get them into those types of roles. Mm-hmm. Or they may not have had those opportunities to be able to progress their career because they've been stuck, because they haven't had that support of
Can I say that was really what happened to me? You know, I think that finishing school, I failed school, you know, you're told that, you know, if you don't do well in school, you're never going to be able to go on and do great things, or you're going to have to do a job where, you know, you're not going to get paid much or something like that. And I think for me, I believed that for such a long time, you know. So sometimes we're setting these young people up for failure, and really it's hard to find that support or even that direction to go, hang on, maybe you did fail school, but there are other directions, if that makes sense.
When I you know, think back in hindsight to school, mm-hmm. the amount of kids, you know, who I can see now, you know, would have been dyslexic, who were failed out of the system and told that they just weren't good enough. It's pretty distressing, really, that culture around that. I mean, I think a lot of it is a culture of ignorance. Schools and the education department perhaps don't understand what they're dealing with. But, do you know if there's much of a sea change in that regard, Shay?
I think that there is a big movement happening in schools, but it's not enough.
Yeah.
It's really, and I think, you know, if children don't get access to assessments and intervention in primary school, the trajectory is so much harder for them. Yeah. And, you know, a lot of it comes down to cost and significant waiting lists for families. And that's what the secondary findings from my research really came down to, those family networks and the social inequality that we're facing. When we don't get access early and consistent access, it's expensive to get intervention for someone that's got a reading difficulty, because it's consistent practice that you need to do. And we're never going to be the same as someone who doesn't have dyslexia, but we really need to be able to put those interventions in so you leave school with functional literacy skills that enable you to get a job that you want to do. And that's the piece that's missing at the moment. And there's a lot of work that's been done, and we've come a long way. I don't work in the children's space. I specifically and stayed out of that for many reasons.
Can I say on that, right, like, I think there is already enough people doing work in that space. And, you know, with the adult dyslexia stuff, there really is very little stuff. Even the research is very, because, you know, whenever I've spoken, they're like, oh, what's the research on that? It's like, well, they're actually, I don't know where to find this research. It doesn't exist. And then also too, you know, it's like, okay, well, say if someone, I get people reaching out to me all the time saying, hey, where can I get an assessment done? And it's fair, even if you Google like adult dyslexia assessments, it's very difficult to find. And, you know, I think you're heading in the right direction.
I think it's, not to take away from the dyslexia part of the conversation, but it seems that way across the board with neurodivergence, which is like a lot of people saying, oh, you know, every other adult and his dog now is getting diagnosed. Like, well, yes, but that's because the focus, I think, primarily, and it seems to me across most neurodivergences, was on children and all the people. So if you didn't get diagnosed, then you kind of missed the boat and just had to struggle through life. So. It's good to see more focus on adulthood now.
Also, too, it sometimes feels that, like, okay, you're dyslexic, say, in school, and then it's like, okay, you finished school, yep, you're not dyslexic anymore, see you later. That's yeah. Like, honestly, it feels like that. Do you know what I mean, Shay?
Yeah, and I mean, all the evidence and our personal lived experience tells us that, you know, if you've been lucky enough to get that support in school and you go on to TAFE or university, then you should, by law, still be getting that support. But once we get out into the workplace, it's just, you know, even now, like when I go out to talk to companies, I'll say, oh, yeah, one intern are dyslexic, and they'll look at me and their mouths will drop open. They're like, what? I'm like, yeah, you know, you have got, unless you've got an organisation of 10 or under, then you're going to have a dyslexic employee. Mm-hmm. And so it's not just we might have. And there are companies that have, you know, been running for years and years, and they said, oh, no, we don't have any dyslexics in our organisation. They've got 300 staff.
Yeah.
No one's ever told us. It's like, well, because it's not safe to tell you.
Yeah. Do you know what? I reached out to a theatre company because I think it was for another podcast I used to have. It was around dyslexia, right? And I said, look, do you have any dyslexic, you know, people in theatre there? And they're like, look, no, we don't have anyone like that here. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I'm like, you know nothing. You know, it's just so frustrating.
It is. And it's so common for organisations to say, we don't have that problem.
Yeah.
So either their staff have got exceptionally good coping strategies to manage in their roles, or they get performance managed out.
Yeah, totally.
And that's what I see a lot of.
Yeah, crazy. So, you know, talking about the workplace, all of that, what do dyslexic people bring to the workplace? You know, what would be some, you know, strengths there and or things to be mindful of as well?
I think, you know, at the core, our difficulties are reading, writing and spelling. So if you're a manager or you're overseeing a team, you know, they're some of the things you might consistently notice is that poor spelling or sentence structure. Someone might be reluctant to get up and write in front of the team or to take notes with the team because they struggle to remember and then to then be able to write it down and remember how to spell the words. So there's a lot of different tasks involved in writing notes or minutes for a meeting. So there might be some reluctance. You might have the team member working longer hours to keep up with their peers as well. So then you might find they come in early or they're working over lunch or staying back late. I mean, one of the biggest risk factors for organisations is dyslexics tend to send work outside of the organisation if they can't get support inside for that editing help. And so then you've got your IP going in and out. So from an organisation's perspective, there's a number of risk factors that they should be looking at to see how they could be supporting their dyslexic employees. But like anyone, when I talk, you know, we all come with a set of challenges or areas for development in a role. We're not, we don't come as a perfect package. And so everyone needs learning and development support in certain areas in their role, whether it's to help them progress in their career, in that job, or, you know, new techniques that they haven't come with that skill set. And I think for dyslexics, what we seem to find is that they are generally resilient and persistent. But more importantly, you know, we look at AI coming in, and that's where a lot of processes can be taken over in jobs, where dyslexics seem to have those really strong soft skills, so empathetic, high emotional intelligence. And look, my husband says that, you know, there's a lot of dyslexics in our family. We don't demonstrate those two skills. But I don't believe that's true. I'm sure I'm highly emotionally intelligent, but, you know, we're really good problem solvers. Because we have to do a lot of workarounds, I think, without that support, we're able to problem solve really quickly.
It just comes naturally, wouldn't you say?
Yeah. Well, I think because we've been in environments where we've had to be able to manage without the support, so we're really good at those problem solving and looking more strategically and like long-term visionary. Thinking for some people they can see in 3D. I don't know if I can or not.
Can I say, sometimes because I am such a visionary type of thing with my thinking and probably my 3D thinking or whatever you call it, sometimes I find that may play with my depression because I can visually see what it needs to be and what it looks like, right? But then I'm not quite there yet. Do you know what I mean? And it's sort of like, oh, you know, or I'm getting depressed because others can't see what I can see type of thing. Or they're going, no, that can't be done. And it's like, yeah, but you haven't even tried. Do you know what I mean? Little things like that.
Yeah, and I think because sometimes we're so big pictured, it's hard for us to articulate the detail of how to get there. And I find that when I work with my team, because I work at Murdoch Children's Research Institute as well, and like I can see that big end goal, and sometimes I can't explain like how we're going to get there, and so that can be frustrating for other team members who are really processed or really detailed, and so then you can find sometimes that you might be at loggerheads because you're like, well, I don't think that way, and you're so detailed, I can't actually absorb the information because it's just going over my head. Because that's not, my brain can't process so much information. So it can be hard because, you know, we can see the end point so clearly. It's like with my business, you know, I can see it in this global context. But there are days like today where my clients didn't attend where I'm like, well, actually, what is my process to get there? So I can see, like with when I first started podcasts, I'd listened to three. I'd never done a podcast before. And I just said to my mum, I'm going to start podcast. She said, okay. So what we're really good at is researching and finding the information about how we can do things. But, you know, I've had to sit down and tell you the process of how to produce a podcast, I'd really struggle because it's just in my head and I just know how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that can be challenging.
And sorry, can I also say it's probably done in a way, you probably produce your podcast in a way that is completely different to how it's normally like done, but it works. Do you know what I mean? And I think that's sometimes how people are like, what you do it that way? And it's like, yeah, but it works, you know? And I think that's the main point.
And I think that's how dyslexic brains are. Like they say, if you think of a train line going straight, that's not our brain. Our train would go, it would deviate in multiple ways. It couldn't go straight. And that, yeah, we all get to the end point, but it just takes us a different way. And sometimes it can take us longer.
And speaking from an autism point of view, that's similar. I think a lot of employers that I've had in the past haven't understood that, you know, I'm getting to the same point, but they're upset that I'm not getting there the same way through processes or however it is they prefer to get there. And they don't understand that doing it the way that they're asking me to do it creates a challenge where I might not reach that endpoint. So it needs to be more results-based rather than following processes and stuff.
Do you know what, right? In regards to reaching that end point, for example, right, I find that, like, it might be a bit of a, you know, off everywhere to get to that end point. But because of my problem-solving skills, the more I do that, I then refine it. I refine it, just keep on refining it, that it becomes so easy and simple than what anyone else can do. And I think that's the innovation side of things really kicking in, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, you go, Shay.
I was just thinking from your comment around when Will and I last saw each other up in Queensland for the neurodiversity conference we were at, or summit.
Symposium,
yeah. It's wild now. And I was there. I can't remember which one it was. There's a lot of people there, though. But at the start, I was thinking, you know, why am I here with ADHDers and autistics? And, you know, we're none of us are the same. When, you know, we're so different. And that was a real eye-opener for me and a real starting point for understanding neurodivergence, I think, because in a lot of ways, if we're looking in the workplace, there are a lot of things that we can implement that support our neurodivergent community in general.
Mm-hmm.
And then we need to go down, become granular in then what actual specific support someone might need. And for dyslexics, you know, it's our literacy support, where someone that's autistic might need, you know, some sensory support or something like that. But there are some general things that our organisations can put in place that actually support us as a group, before they need to then go down granular into the individual support.
Yeah, myself being a big nerd, I was very into the X-Men when I was a kid, and I didn't quite understand why, but I was actually watching a 60-year anniversary thing yesterday, and they were talking to some of the writers from the 80s, 90s stuff, and they were saying it was the family element. It was that they were all different, which was what made them the same, but they were different from each other, if you know what I mean. So they were still sort of, They were in a world that wasn't built for them, even though they were quite different from each other. And sense of family and community is what made them effective. So I think that's how, a good way for us to approach it.
But do you know what, right? Ooh. Like, I do sort of find that, yeah, we sort of are, well, you know, neurodiversity, we're all different in a way because, like, you know, you never meet two autistic people who are exactly the same or two dyslexic people. But I sometimes feel we have had similar journeys. Do you know what I mean? Where we can relate. So a lot of the time when I may meet someone who's autistic and ADHD or whatever, I sort of have a similar story and can relate type of thing. That's where I sort of connect the dots type of thing together, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's very rare to meet someone who's neurodiverse that only has one condition or difficulty or you know, it's the research tells us that we have more than one.
Well, and it wasn't until I got into the community and learned that I'm like, well, what else am I? Do you know what I mean? And then found out I was ADHD.
And I'm currently on the verge of an ADHD diagnosis as well, so on top of the autism.
And it's funny you both say that because I'm very tempted to go and get an ADHD assessment this year.
Really?
And only because I can do multiple things, it's people keep telling me how strange that is. Like for me, it's always been normal. And I don't know if it's a dyslexic thing or whether it is an ADHD thing, that multiple tasking and, you know, just your brain not shutting down at the end of the day where you're constantly, your brain is still rushing and, you know, I'll start an email and I'll do three sentences and then I'll go off and do something else. It's very, and I still get all my work done, but I just, my brain can't function on just one task at a time. I have to be doing multiple tasks at a time. And that's the only reason. I mean, it's not, I don't want to then become an ADHD advocate. You know, my area of expertise is dyslexia and that's where I'd stay. But it was just a personal, is that how my brain works? And so many adults say that medication actually really helps them.
Well, I haven't actually, when I got diagnosed, I was told I didn't. So because I was diagnosed so late, apparently, because I've got like, so I'm what they class as like twice exceptional. And what apparently has happened is my brain has apparently sort of rewired itself to be able to handle and cope with whatever I need to do in regards to my ADHD. But now I know I have ADHD, it's more I'm mindful of it, but I don't really need medication where other people... Yeah, they definitely need that. So sometimes I think it really does come down to the individual as well.
There's a really good, I know, TED Talk, but there's a good TED Talk by a guy called Tim Urban, Inside the Mind of a Master Procrastinator, and he talks a lot about what you were just saying, Shay, how he'll do one thing for a little bit and then he'll go and be productive at another thing for a little bit and then he'll come back to that. And that's how he had to teach himself to get things done, because when he just sat down and tried to do the one thing for hours at a time, it just... Nothing would happen.
I actually do that because I feel like my brain's sort of like burnt out from that one task and I need something new and fresh. I even need to, like, I can't sit there and watch like a sports game. I need to have the sports game there playing, like, I don't know, the basketball, for example, and I need to be working on something at the same time. Do you know what I mean? Yeah,
I'm exactly like that. Exactly like that, yeah.
And I love it like that. If I try and sit there and work on something without the basketball or sports in the background, I'll go insane. I'll be like, man, depression, blah, you know what I mean? I just can't do it. And I can't complete the task. I feel like I can complete the task when I've got something else happening there, which probably sounds really strange.
No, I've had employers come to me and be like, you know, you're watching a lot of YouTube. I'm like, yeah, but I'm working for 10 minutes, watching YouTube for a couple of minutes, then going back to the work, and it's keeping me on task.
Stimulated type of thing.
Yeah.
But you know what, Shay? Like, I think the thing is, like, how can we make it easier for employers to better understand dyslexia? I think, you know, we said before, like, and, you know, you said something before, and I thought, I remember when I was younger, I was open about being dyslexic to an employer and they just had no idea. And I said, look, I want to, am I able to try and do something so I'm able to move up the ladder type of thing? And they'd give me tasks like doing the meetings minutes at like meetings and all that. So that was setting me up for failure without probably even realizing it. So how can we make it easier for employers to better understand dyslexia?
They need training. And lots of
easy terms. Yeah, totally.
That's the easiest answer. And look, it's not easy. I think it's a two-pronged approach where the more dyslexics feel empowered to disclose their dyslexia really helps, because if an employer doesn't think they have dyslexic people, then they're not going to get trained. You know, they don't think there's any challenges or issues or concerns in their organisation. So, and that's really scary and that's really hard. And if your workplace isn't inclusive and supportive and encouraging of people to come out and talk about these difficulties, then we're less likely to see that happen. But from an employer's perspective, they really need to be looking at whole of organisational training so that everyone understands neurodiverse and neurodivergence, because, you know, we make up 20% of the workforce. It's not small. You know, that's nearly a quarter of our workforce are neurodivergent. And we're really well versed in mental health now, as we should be, but that's taken a long time. But we need to look at the complexities of it, the neurodiverse employees and those mental health risk factors that we're already facing, and making it safe for them to be able to come out to talk about it. And then having that training for managers and HR is really important, because what we can see is across the employment life cycle, from recruitment through to career progression, there's a number of barriers that dyslexics are facing. And so what we're trying to do is raise that awareness and have offer that training so that they can reduce the barriers and ensure that either they're recruiting the right talent, because they might be missing out on a whole talent pool, not might be, they are missing out on a whole talent pool based on some of the pre-assessments and interview criteria that need to be undertaken at the moment. And they're really archaic ways of assessing someone's skills for the job, I think. And then that retention support, where you're able to ask for workplace adjustments and not feel ashamed, and that it's not, oh, we don't know if we have the money, because the money's there. We've just piloted a job access funding project with Hampton Park that we're about to start promoting. And so dyslexics can get $1,500 worth of learning support with me, and then we can have $1,500 to run training in an organisation.
Is that and just in Australia?
Yeah, I mean, this is just Australian.
Just in Victoria?
No, so this is federally. We're about to start promoting it. Yeah. And so what we're doing is we're able to pool. So if you've got more than one dyslexic employee, we can pool that funding to roll out more tailored specific training for that organisation. So we're offering a wraparound service where they have sessions with me and we look at what they need, and then we're able to build out the organisation's capacity for that inclusion and support for their dyslexic employees. Really, and if someone thinks they're dyslexic, they can come to us and we're doing like a dyslexic screener that's been that we're able to use to help apply for that funding as well.
So they don't have to necessarily be diagnosed with dyslexia. They could just show signs of it to be eligible for this?
Well, if someone self-identifies, then they can come to us and we can do a dyslexic screen, and that's a separate cost. But it's not the same cost of going and getting a full assessment. And that dyslexic screening paperwork at the moment is what Job Access needs to say, yes, this person is having difficulties. They are and some of the testing, it's an AI screening tool that looks at your reading, and so it says what reading level you're at. So there's a couple of different bits of documentation we put together, and we submit that as part of the process, and people are able to get that funding support. And then the organisation can get that training support. And so really that's the main bit of work that I'm focusing at the moment, is trying to get all of that ready so when we go live we can be offering this around the country. And it's open to all neurodivergents, so it's not just dyslexics that can access this funding, ADHD, autistic. So I'm working with someone with ADHD at the moment because their challenges are similar to what we face as dyslexics as well. So it's a federal funded program. It's the first time we've ever found funding that can support adults in the neurodivergent space.
Hey, good on you. Awesome
stuff. So, yeah, it's taken a lot of research, and it's spent the last 6 months piloting it and getting it ready to go live. And, yeah, it's really exciting that we can do this. And
That's the first I've ever heard of that, and I'm interested to see how it all goes. And please let us know if we can help share it and get people on board. I think that will, because I think this is the thing. People wouldn't know.
No.
You know, people wouldn't know that that's available. Do you know what I mean? And that's the hard part.
Yeah, and then you've got to be able to have it. This is the, you know, there's so many barriers because we've been piloting this and testing the formula, and, you know, you have to, I applied for it for myself through the business, but I wanted some math support. I don't have dyscalculia, but my maths is quite poor. But because it was an accountant who was going to do some finance coaching with me, we couldn't get it across the line because they weren't allied health. So there's all these different barriers, but we've been able to address those, but partly because I'm a speech pathologist and I've got a psych working with me, Dr. Judith Hudson as well. It's taken us some time to nut out all these barriers and to be able to address them, and there's been quite a lot of tears and frustrations at the stuff we have to go through, you know, because you can see why someone doesn't apply for it, because there are so many, there's paperwork and there's so many requirements, and I'm just excited we've been able to get through all of that and be able to really provide some tailored support, not just for the dyslexic person, but for the workplace as well.
That is really awesome. But, you know, in saying that, you know, what are some of the best accommodations that a workplace could make to help dyslexic, so they could go do this course one, you know what I mean? But this is the thing, you know, I'm sure that a lot of workplaces don't understand what accommodations they might need. One of the things I find is that some workplaces probably already have a lot of accommodations in place without even realizing it. What's your experience been like, Shay?
Yeah, and I think they think it's really expensive and hard, and it's so not. If you know, like Microsoft has improved its dictation and text-to-speech so much that if you're dyslexic and you want to not disclose, that's the first, easiest, cheapest, hidden tool we can use. Mm. You know, a lot of dyslexics can we can hear the mistakes, but we can't see them if we're editing our work. So if we're listening and watching at the same time, it's easier for us to edit. You know, Siri is another thing. Siri is my best friend, especially since working from home. Oh, there's my little daughter. Oh, you can't see
her. Oh, nice.
Yes, yeah, wouldn't surprise me. No. I don't want to pigeonhole her into being neurodivergent, but it's very likely. It's a high possibility.
All good.
Siri is gorgeous. But, you know, Siri, especially now because my husband, we don't work in the same rooms, thank goodness, we kill each other, but we're not in the office a lot. So I talk to Siri all the time to help me with my spelling now if I can't find a word. And if you're in the workplace, again, that's such a simple tool. Everyone has their phone at work. Grammarly is another one that's really easy. I use ChatGTP a lot now to help me restructure my writing as well.
I was about to ask, yeah.
Yeah.
Do you think AI is going to help a lot more in this sense in the future?
I think it's game-changing for us. I mean, I used to use something called WordTune, so if I couldn't get my sentence right, I would put it in it and it would rewrite it for me in about 7 different ways. And so I'll still use that now. If I can't get it, I know it can sound better and I'm stuck with how to reword it. So there's tools like that, and through the Job Access Program, the government will fund that. But it's not just technology that helps us. I really think that one-on-one coaching is really important to be able to talk to someone about the challenges you're facing in the workplace and to be able to build up your skills around self-advocacy and just having a peer to talk to. I think it's really important.
Oh, no, you're dead right, because I think the thing is, especially with the rise of technology, you know, I'm seeing so many like, hey, this is for ADHD or this is for dyslexia or this is for autism, right, or whatever tool it is, right? But all it's done is cut out the people factor, and I think a big thing is the connection there, you know, especially when – you know, because I think a big thing is, this is nothing against Microsoft. I like a lot of the stuff Microsoft are doing, and I'm actually in talks with Microsoft in regards to some stuff at the moment. But the hardest thing with some of the Microsoft tools is, where are they? Do you know what I mean? You usually got to drop down something and then go into something else and then find that or click something and then it's there and all that.
I find Microsoft's websites to be like government websites. They're just like, go to our website. We've got all these amazing resources, and I get there, and I'm like, where
it's
the hell?
It's all reading. You cannot connect with a person and have that personal, like, and sometimes that's what we need. We need to be able to talk to someone and go, hey, look, I can't find this, and you know, little things like that. So you're dead right, Shay.
And I think even you're right, with some of the clients I've worked with, you know, we've done screenshots and saved it all, and I've talked them through, this is how we install it on your computer, and then, you know, they might be on their home computer, so we've mapped it out so they can go and do it themselves. So you're building those skills and that capacity to be independent. But also we do need someone to talk to. Like, I can't, my writing's at a certain level where I need a human being. AI can only do so much, you know, and I need someone to sit down and talk through and work through it with me. So we'll never... we will always need that connection. But it's, I think they're the main things that we're finding really helpful. And for some people, we found that the coaching costs are too expensive. So we're about to launch a group session where people can come once a month and we talk about a topic that's important, like mental health or workplace adjustments. And people can come and have that peer support and be able to listen to someone and get that help they need on a monthly basis.
Can I say, sorry, Just on you were talking about AI and that before, I've tried to use some AI, like, you know, things to help with writing a blog or whatever like that to make it faster. Not that I don't mind writing, do you know what I mean? Because I'm actually good at sharing stories in Word format. Just sometimes that Word format might not be the best. But what I've found when I have used AI to try and do that, it just doesn't bring me out in that writing. It just doesn't sound right, if that makes sense.
And I think that's where a lot of people don't understand AI is a long way from being useful, especially if you want it to sound like yourself, you know. I don't know, following the technology, I believe there might come a day where that is possible, and I think it might be closer than we think, but I think for a good while yet, you know, I'm not being replaced in my job of search engine optimization, because there's a lot of human consideration and stuff, and, you know, content marketing is very human. So I think
it'd be hard to do a podcast again with an AI.
Yes, that is very true. And I really need help with search optimization, but I won't derail us. But you're right. But, you know, Will, it can help you have a framework. And so I use ChatGTP. It writes my blogs for me, so it gives me the framework. And then what I do then is spend half an hour going in and personalizing it to make it so it is coming from me. But having that structure really helps me, one, because I couldn't get the blogs out like I do so quickly with all the other things I'm trying to do. And so I also get it to help me write my website copy. I get it to help me with my Facebook ads. So I give it it's a lot of playing around with, and it does take a bit more time, but it is a lot less time in the end, because the personalization is you, and you're right, that will never be replaced, and so it's a good framework.
And I think as well that, you know, you're talking about Facebook ads and posting and all that, I think, you know, those types of things, that's perfect for all of that, you know what I mean? But if I was going to write a letter to my wife and I got an AI bot to do it, she'd be like, "Will, what's wrong with you?" But anyway.
Yeah.
But in saying that, you know, what do dyslexic leaders need to do to help this conversation along in the workplace? Because, you know, I think especially when you and I first met, Shay, all of those years ago, are you sort of finding that it is starting to get spoken about a bit more? We are starting to see some people in higher places really start to say, "Hey, look, I'm actually dyslexic myself," things like that.
I think the movement's occurring overseas, particularly in the UK, and I think, you know, Made by Dyslexia has done some great awareness raising around high-profile people with dyslexia. But from my experience within the Australian context, I think sometimes if people are at a higher level and there's no risk factor to their reputation anymore, then they may come out. But generally, we're not seeing a huge amount of leaders come out and say they're dyslexic. You know, with the charity, people say, "Oh, go and find a famous person to be your ambassador." And, you know, if you look at the dyslexic famous people, there's probably 10, you know, or maybe 15 we could reel off at the top of our heads. And so it's not just famous people that we need to step out of the shadows, because, you know, that's a different subgroup. What we need is leaders, like in the high, you know, whether you're a CEO, a board director, a manager, you know, if you're neurodivergent, regardless of dyslexia, whatever it might be, the more people that can say, "This is me and these are my difficulties, but this is how I manage them, and I manage them so well, I'm in these really high up roles." Until we can start to have that culture change, it's really hard, I think, for the rest of the teams and organisations to say stuff.
And you know what, right, in saying that, right, you know, I know, and I'm not going to name this company, but I know of a really big worldwide company that's based here in Australia. One of the co-founders is dyslexic, I know for a fact. And, you know, I tried to go to that person and all that, and, you know, they really, you know, what their words were was like, you know, "I don't want to become the dyslexia pin boy for this," you know. And it's like, yeah, but, you know, you're doing so well. You would be you would be doing so much by even just saying something rather than nothing, or using your company as an example of, you know, all of this type of thing. And it was almost disappointing to hear that, if that makes sense.
Yeah, we were on, I was working with the company the other month, and one of the directors was going to be doing some work with me, and in the end they stepped off and said, oh no, I don't need to be involved. I'll let the rest of the group go out publicly. Even though they speak publicly in their workplace, they stepped back. And I felt really disappointed that we couldn't have that type of high level representation, because it is so important. And, you know, and there's a lot of different reasons why people don't want to be that dyslexic poster person, because they're managing, it doesn't really impact them and their life is okay. And that's great. But the research tells us that's not the case for a lot of dyslexics. And we do need some, you know, higher level managers and leaders stepping out and saying, this is my challenge and it's okay.
Well, do you know what? When I was younger, I remember sitting, and I share this story quite often, right? You know, I remember sitting in, I was kept in at lunchtime because I was bad, doing lines in the room, and I was so frustrated, pissed off with my teacher, all of that. And I remember in the back of my head thinking, you know, because I remember my parents would always point out famous, like, you know, Tom Cruise or Kerry Packer and stuff like that. You know, they were dyslexic and they've done really well. And I always used to think to myself, okay, well, how were they ever to do it? And it's sort of, you know, and I think about that because it's sort of like that has given me sort of that motivation to go, okay, well, you know, if these people who are doing really well has, you know, lived with this and been able to, you know, go on and do great things, maybe I could do the same as well, you know. And that's been a real sort of thing. And I think the thing that sometimes annoys me with some of these leaders who do identify as dyslexic or neurodivergent is I see them doing things in other spaces. Do you know what I mean? And I think, man, like, you're one of us. Do you know what I mean? And you're not behind us. Like, in a way, it's sort of like that's not leadership, my man.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's really hard. I think, you know, we come with so much trauma from our schooling, and I think sometimes the feelings of shame and embarrassment, like there's these deep-seated traumas that we have faced around our self-worth. And I don't want to get emotional.
If I could, again, come from the autistic perspective, I feel like that conversation might be a little ahead, because I know that I had those feelings of embarrassment and you know, just not understanding where I fit in society, that kind of stuff. And then in recent years, we've seen it's become almost in a bad way glamorized, but you know, everyone is coming out now and talking about it, famous people, and it that really helped. And I'm seeing the flow and effect of that, and it's exactly what you're saying. We needed those people to come out like that for us to feel comfortable and thrive, and for society to start to have a different conversation, because for better or worse, they see celebrities or, you know, business people or whatever saying that they have this, and they give that weight, I guess.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, it's great that they're coming out. Made by Dyslexia has made some huge progress around dyslexic awareness. But sometimes, like for me, I worry that it marginalizes, because we, you know, some of the labels around superpower and genius and dyslexic, you know, and dyslexic thinking is the thing at the moment. And, you know, there's not, for me, confident evidence that we do think differently. It's very apparent, like we can see that we do. But so I think that sometimes these labels and can polarize, and there's a lot of people that don't resonate or feel that, you know, they're never going to be like that, and their life's just going to be crappy. And so it's hard because it's changing the narrative in good ways, and then it's also, I think sometimes it could be polarizing.
But
there's no answer.
Sometimes I see with some of these famous people who are behind these big charities, sometimes those charities, they're doing good awareness, but sometimes the information they're sharing, and like you said before, it's not evidence-based, or the, you know, I've seen some release a dyslexia document in the workplace and it wasn't even dyslexic friendly to read. Do you know what I mean? And it's sort of like, and it's sometimes frustrating because it's like, that's not, you know, you're missing the point. But because they've got these big stars behind them, everyone lauds them.
But this is why I think, you know, you use those big stars or those famous business people to get the message out and make the conversation happen. But once that's happening, this is where we need to come in and advocate for ourselves to get the conversation happening correctly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I think the conversation's been had for us for so long. You know, whether it's been our parents, and that's not, I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but, you know, we were too young to self-advocate and have a voice. But I feel like sometimes our voice has been taken away from us because there's professionals and experts and, you know, charities or multiple people speaking on our behalf, and we're not actually sitting at the table a lot of the time. Mm. As adults, being able to share our lived experience, the positive and the negative, because there's both sides to it.
Totally, totally. Out of so we're getting close to the end here, and we might need to wrap it up in a sec. So, is there any interesting research that you'd like to speak on this topic? That's probably for a whole nother episode. But you know, where could people maybe find some of this research? I should probably say, or you know, where is some good stuff being done? I know you're doing some great stuff, so you can plug yourself.
I'll plug myself. Well, first they can go to Rethink Dyslexia to see our published research. And my thesis has been turned into a book, so hopefully that will be launched in the next couple of months. And that's really to try and bring out the dyslexic voice from an adult's perspective. That's a useful, practical resource. But there's some amazing work done by Stephen McDonald in the UK, Neil Alexander Passe as well. And I can send you a list, Will, of different researchers. But what I've found is that there's not a lot of researchers like myself that are dyslexic that are just focusing on the lived experience of adults, and particularly in the workplace. And that's really exciting that, like, we're leading the way in that sense.
It is, because I can tell you right now, when people come to me, like, you know, because what I'm working towards is more working with universities in the vet sector and all that type of stuff, right? So, you know, dyslexia in the workplace isn't really my forte, if that's the word I'm looking for. So, you know, knowing people like yourself are around, that's really key, because, you know, a lot of the other stuff is all really just people. And, you know, I think as well is that sometimes we've got to realize that dyslexia isn't just reading and writing. I can read and write not too bad. Do you know what I mean? So there is a lot of other things as well, especially when it does come to the workplace, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I think my research demonstrates that, and I think some of the stuff we've talked about today also highlights that. But I think the biggest link is that job burnout and mental fatigue that we end up facing that really impacts on our well-being and our mental health. And I think that's one of the biggest things that needs to be recognised in the workplace.
Totally, totally. Photon John, did you have anything else you wanted to say before we wrap it up?
I admire anyone who can, you know, come through neurodivergence and survive it and thrive. But in particular, people who then feel impassioned to do something about the conversation and for our community and that sort of stuff. So big fan.
Thank you. Awesome.
Shay, for all of the listeners listening here today, where's the best place for them to get in contact with you, to connect with your work, all the amazing stuff you're doing?
Either through rethinkdyslexia.com.au, and we can put that up for people that struggle to spell it, but also LinkedIn. I mean, just connect through me through LinkedIn, through Shay Wasella, our Rethink Dyslexia page, or also Facebook, our Rethink Dyslexia page there. You can contact us if that's easy as well.
Cool. Well, Shay, thank you so much. You're looking well.
Thank you.
You're not that crooked.
I'm not that crooked anymore. I tried to not move.
You're looking well, but thank you so much for coming on today, because, you know, this is a really big topic. It's not spoken about enough. You know, we really need to hear more about this. And I think the work that you're doing is fantastic. And I think it's going to be cool. When you do get that stuff ready, let us know, and I'll try and share with as many people as possible, because I think that could be really beneficial for a lot of people there. So, Shay, thank you so much. And for anyone, please listening, please follow, subscribe, and like to all of our social media platforms. Photon, John, you have anything else you want to say before we leave, my man?
I am good, my man.
You are good. My name's Will Wheeler, and this is the Open Hearted Podcast. Till next time, everyone.
Thank you.